This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Well, good morning. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Florida Spectacular. How are you, Rick?
I'm great. It's summer, seems like.
Is the new air conditioner keeping your attic comfortably?
For the most part. You know, there's certain things. I have little storage areas in each corner of the attic, and I've never done this before, but even with the new air conditioner, if you touch one of the little doors, they're warm. That shows you how little insulation there is in my house.
And Florida is just, as they say, preheating.
It's not even hot yet.
Yes. And that brings us to the third voice on our podcast this morning, Holly Baker. Holly, good morning.
Oh, hello. Good morning. Good morning.
Holly, I'm going to let you talk a little bit more about what you do, but you are here to talk about archaeology and history in Florida in a very broad sense.
I have to admit, I am not an archaeologist, so I can't really say an awful lot about archaeology. There are professional archaeologists I work with who deal with the archaeology on the work that I do. So I tend to focus 100% on history. But I love talking about history. I love talking about Florida history. I'm a public historian. I have a master's degree in public history from the University of Central Florida. I was born in Florida. My family's been in Florida since before statehood. So when I was a little girl, I wanted to grow up and write about Florida history. I knew I was really into history. So I'm thankful that I went for it. And luckily, I've been able to work in history and preservation since about 2015. So 10 years. I'm happy to talk about that with y'all, and since it's Preservation Month especially, and thank you for inviting me.
So, Holly, tell us about what exactly you're doing now, the kind of work you're doing that involves, you know, doing these surveys of historic buildings in different places.
Well, I am now a consultant for a company called Chronicle Heritage, which is primarily archaeologists, by the way. there's probably more than 100 archaeologists at my company, and I believe less than 20 historians. So we help them write their reports. They do their archaeology part of the report, and then we throw in the history. But I have been lucky to, my company is all over the United States, but my office is based in Tallahassee, even though I live in the Orlando area. So I've been able to take part in writing a bunch of National Register nominations, National Historic Landmark nominations, on architectural surveys. So recently I've been in St. Augustine and Vero Beach doing architectural surveys. So that's a cool thing that I got to do. I have to admit, it's one of my career highlights, really, of being able to go down in person and to a neighborhood and document buildings. The St. Augustine survey that I was working on, that I'm still working on, actually, we were concentrating on buildings built in St. Augustine between 1940 and 1980, because a lot of St. Augustine has already been documented. But there are places like African-American neighborhoods and also Davis Shores, which is across the bridge there. We were basically trying to document those, like fill in the gaps of the ones that haven't been documented yet. So, and then in Vero Beach, before I talk about Vero Beach, St. Augustine was 450 buildings. So I think I walked about 8 miles a day, but I had a little iPad with ArcGIS field maps on there. So I could go around and take pictures of the buildings. And then eventually they're going to have a Florida Master Site File form filled out for each property. I'm working on that now. Actually, today when I get done with the interview, I'll be plugging some of those in. But it's a neat opportunity to document buildings. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be preserved, but it's the first step in preservation. It's a first step in acknowledging that that building's there and it has a history. And a lot of people concentrate on buildings before 1940s, but there's interesting character in buildings built after World War II. The post-war, you know, ranch style houses, they're not, you know, spectacular looking like a Mediterranean Revival building, but it's still important. It's still, you can look at it and tell it kind of, you can look at it and tell that it was built, you know, at this certain time. And
so
I like
you,
that.
Let me ask you, can you talk about maybe a little bit of a different time frame than I think a lot of people associate with St. Augustine? Can you talk maybe about one or two of the buildings that you're working on that may have some historic significance?
I have to admit, we are still in that phase of deciding what our recommendations are for certain ones of those. Some that I would like to say, oh, these cool ranch houses really spoke to me, but I still like Mediterranean Revival, you know. There was an apartment building that I really liked. It used to be called Royal Viking, and now I think it's called Royal Park. It's a three-story apartment building, Mediterranean Revival, built in the 20s. We noticed it hadn't been documented yet in the Florida Master Site file, so I wanted to make sure that one was remembered. A lot of Davis Shores buildings I really like. Davis Shores was built in the 1920s by D.P. Davis, and he wanted to make this spectacular neighborhood on Anastasia Island filled with golf courses and, you know, Mediterranean Revival buildings. But it was during the time of the land boom bust. So right when he got his extravagant neighborhood started, and by the way, he had to bring in, you know, he had to dredge to bring in so that there could be foundation enough for buildings to even be built there. So and he did something similar in Tampa as well. But the buildings, only 11 of the Mediterranean Revival ones were ever built. So and then right after that, D.P. Davis went on a cruise to Europe and fell overboard or jumped overboard, like right at that same time. So it was just, you know, the story of Davis Shores is kind of sad and weird to me. And also the Bridge of Lions was built basically as an elaborate entrance to Davis Shores. So, you know, I it's interesting to see, you know, the beautiful lions that were crafted in Italy to kind of showcase how opulent it was going to be in Davis Shores. And then nothing, you know, the Davis Shores that D.P. Davis envisioned never happened. But I you can still see 11 of the original Mediterranean Revival buildings. Those buildings, I definitely, when I was in Davis Shores, I was noticing, you know, there's the 1920s looking Davis Shores, and then there's the post-war Davis Shores. It's got all the ranch buildings. So you can kind of see the history of the area just by looking through Davis Shores, really. The ones that stuck out to me are those probably original ones.
There's a lot of places like that in Orlando that were started to be developed in the, you know, the 1920s boom, and then the bust hit, and then their infill came, you know, in the post-war period. So, you know, there's a neighborhood across from me called Lancaster Park, and you see 1920s houses, 1940s houses, 1960s houses, this kind of weird mishmash. But I think it gives the neighborhood character, and I like mid-century houses, you know, if they're done well. They're not all done well. So was Davis Shores, because I know Davis Island in Tampa, was it going to be on both sides of the, as you come over the Bridge of Lions, was going to be on both sides? Because I thought it was mainly to the left.
It is mainly to the left, but I believe that he had plans for it to be larger than that.
Okay.
But yeah, it's when you go into Davis Shores, it is smaller than I thought it would be, because, you know, it's such a big story about it, and about his just plan and dream. So yeah. And then in Vero Beach, I did something similar, like I did in St. Augustine. I documented 325 buildings, and actually was intrigued to notice that there's not been a lot of surveys done in Vero Beach. When I was a kid, I lived in Vero Beach. So it was really cool when they asked me to go do field work there, and a place where I used to ride my bike with my brother. I didn't know much about, you know, the architecture, of course. As a kid, I was just riding my bikes with my brother, and we would go to Pocahontas Park, and we would play on that that old plane there, the Banshee plane, that was used by the Navy and the Marines. We would crawl all over that and play all over it. And then eventually they removed it in, I believe, 1988 to a museum, the Aviation Museum in Pensacola. So it was really cool walking with my 8 miles a day with my iPad, documenting buildings in Vero Beach. And it was close to my heart because I know that so many of those buildings have never been documented before. So, and, you know, right across the street from where I lived when I was a kid, there were buildings. Where I lived as a kid is a parking lot now for the Methodist Church on 18th Avenue. But yeah, in Vero Beach, it was, I would say more, even though, and we had no, for that one, we had no limit. It wasn't like 1940 through 1980. It was just any building. So McAnch Park has a lot of buildings from the 1920s. Beautiful, again, Mediterranean Revival, which I think must be my favorite type of style because my eye is always drawn to those buildings. So there were a lot of those around in Vero Beach. And when I was a kid, I just didn't know all the beautiful buildings that I was lucky enough to go by every day on my bike.
Yeah, it seems to me like Vero Beach is a place where historic architecture would be threatened because of just, you know, it's a well-to-do area and it doesn't seem like they would value it. You know, my knowledge base is mostly around Waldo Sexton and his structures, but there's got to be a lot of cool stuff. Is there old theater there?
Yes, there's old theater there downtown. It's a beautiful old theater. And actually right now, it doesn't seem like it's really being used. I feel like that one is probably one that would be safe. I often think about the sense of place and how buildings are remembered and due to like your own personal connection to the building. And I feel like Vero Beach has some like that, that are downtown, just the original, like beautiful theaters. But there are more of the just frame vernacular buildings. Some are not even really very, you can't see style really. It's just like a mishmash of styles and whatnot. But definitely, there are some beautiful, beautiful homes from the 20s and whatnot. That just apparently my time frame that I really like. But the 20s and 30s, I like those. Even the simple frame vernacular buildings, I love them. They have character. The craftsman buildings, like the kind my grandma lived in when I was a kid. Any kind of building with a beautiful screen porch, I agree with you though. I think that Vero Beach has gotten a reputation as a kind of an upscale type community.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, it was citrus farmers and people like that, So yeah. I am concerned that some of that citrus heritage would be erased for, when they're doing infrastructure projects, widening highways and whatnot, which tends to happen. May hurt the character of some of these neighborhoods, but that's why I'm glad that I'm first step, like I say, is documenting it and then letting people know this is an important building and it's worth saving, and trying to get it on the National Register of Historic Properties is very important. If it's possible, you always try to, if it's got integrity, if it's still got integrity, it can possibly go on that list. And then that'll offer it some, some bit of protection, some tax incentives, possibilities for grants. And
yeah. What are the qualifications for the historic? I'm sorry, Kathy.
No, I was going to ask the same thing because we are forever dealing with where I live. We have these homes that were built and honestly, some of them not built very well. But they're old and they're getting raised, and some people get very, very upset. And as a historian myself, it's kind of delicate to explain, look, just because something is old doesn't mean it's historic. So I think it would be really helpful if everybody could understand from a professional what makes an old building historic, because it's not just that it's 100 years old.
Right.
Yes. Well, to be on the National Register, they wanted to have, association with a famous person or a famous event. It has to have not been altered too terribly much from its original form. That the integrity has to be there. Again, like the it's still in good shape, you know. So there are a lot of things architecturally important is another one. So there are, it's like there are the different qualifications. They don't have to meet them all. They could just meet one or two of them, but it has to meet something on the just like a top five, you know, of qualifications it must meet. And integrity means like workmanship, you know, location, feeling. There's seven aspects of integrity. So, you know, you just have to use your judgment as a historian when you're and also we're making recommendations. We're not deciding. You know, unfortunately, that's the part that hurts my heart. Like I can tell an agency that this building is important and here's why, but they can take my recommendation, but they may decide to do their project anyway, you know? So, but my job is to make a case, you know, that this is an important building and this is why. Like a lot of the buildings that I deal with are not going to be considered eligible for the National Register, but you know, to me that's something that I struggle with because I feel like I still feel like there's that sense of place there. You know, you can see an old barn, you know, that's like it's clearly not going to make it on the National Register of Historic Properties, but maybe it had an important past in the neighborhood, in the community, you know. So I feel like it's still important. I wish we could save every building, everything, you know, and that's the part that hurts me. And I remember in grad school, when I first got into historic preservation classes at UCF, Dr. Ann Lindsay was my professor, and she was amazing and really helped me to get on this road, knowing that I loved historic preservation and I wanted to get into it. But, you know, I was talking about brutalist architecture and thinking, oh, you know, it's ugly, you know. And I remember she was just like, it doesn't matter if it's ugly or not. You know, that's a subjective thing. Like some people think brutalist buildings are beautiful, you know. So and then she also helped me to understand that you can't save every building. You're going to get your heart broken sometimes in historic preservation, but you still keep trying, you still keep fighting. And hopefully that you can save some, you know.
I just want to know what your feeling is about the Orlando Public Library, which is the probably the best example of brutalism in Central Florida. And my experience has been everybody loves it or hates it. I love it. I think it's great.
That's probably the building she was talking about.
Probably.
We were actually there at that building doing research. So I was probably like, this building's so ugly. And she probably told me that, you know, even an ugly building is important. And so I do find it ugly, but I still think it's important. Sorry.
What do you think of it? Do you know the building, Kathy?
No, I mean, not, I haven't been inside of it. I have a very narrow view of what I find aesthetically pleasing. Like, I don't even really find craftsman architecture.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. I'm
not
very...
even like the green and green stuff that's, you know, in California. Or...
I look, you don't want to go down this road. I'll get hate mail. I already got hate mail over my, I'm very unconventional.
Okay.
But I mean, and I respect that all styles have a school and a reason, and that just because I don't like it doesn't mean we should tear it down. And part of my issue with craftsmen may be that in our house, we have this mid-century ranch home that somebody added on to and remodeled and put these giant hurricane craftsman windows in. And to me, it's just so incongruous, I guess, is the word that I just, it nailed. And you can't afford to replace, you know, we have a 3,000 square foot house with these windows throughout, big bay windows. So anyway, that's my own issue. I wanted to talk about, you're talking about, what did you say, 1940s through 1980 architecture in St. Augustine. That dips into some of the Jim Crow. So I'm curious if the buildings under consideration are all on what would have been historically the white side of the city, or if there's anything in Lincolnville under your purview right now.
Yeah, actually, I was going to mention that. That is one of the goals of this survey that I'm working on, is to record buildings in places like Lincolnville and West Augustine, because St. Augustine was a major site during the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King Jr. got arrested in St. Augustine at the, I think it's called the Monson Resort, the same one where there's a swim in, there's a, some folks went in to go swim and the manager of the motel came out and tried to pour acid on them to get them to leave. I believe that was the same day, because also all these rabbis came to help with the protest. It was just a crazy time, and it happened in St. Augustine. But one thing that I'm noticing is that when people talk about the civil rights movement in St. Augustine, they always, and I get it, they always talk about Martin Luther King Jr. But there were people in the community in St. Augustine who were really behind the movement. They were the ones doing the work before Martin Luther King Jr. got there, like local dentists and preachers and things like that. So I've been trying to find people in those neighborhoods, like who live there, and see where did they live. Like Robert Haling was one of the gentlemen who was from West Augustine, who was a dentist there, and his office is still there. So I want to make sure that we are documenting the buildings that people lived in who were in, you know, involved in the local civil rights movement, but you don't really hear their names. Again, like the preachers and whatnot, there were like three or four of them in the Lincolnville neighborhood who were very involved in the civil rights movement in St. Augustine. So what we've been doing is, we had a huge list, like I say, in St. Augustine, 450. So a lot of them were in Fullerwood, Lincolnville, other areas of West Augustine, that are historically Black neighborhoods. So we want to make sure that we document those as well. So that's what we did. But I have to still, you know, I had a list of buildings to document. I went there, I took pictures of them. So now I'm back and I'm finding the history of each building, you know, I spend half the day on newspapers.com and looking at city directories and whatnot, asking myself, who lived here? Did anything important happen here? Is there anybody, affiliated with this house who could help, make this be considered a historic home? So that's what I have been doing with those 450 St. Augustine buildings is, first of all, documenting them, but also trying to see what the connections are there locally.
Lincolnville, every time I go there, I feel like more of the buildings are disappearing. And, you know, it's nice in one respect. So if you're listening and you don't know what Lincolnville was a wholly Black settlement that formed right after Abraham Lincoln freed the enslaved people. And it was kind of isolated in that it had its own businesses, it had its own social structure, its own business community, its own medical community, but it was all Black people. And so as obviously we're integrating, there's not the motivation for a lot of the children and grandchildren to come back and live in those homes. They can live anywhere. But what we're seeing now is definite gentrification. And it seems like every time I go back, more houses are torn down, rebuilt, forever altered. And, you know, it was really a very special place. And I think aspects of it, it's on the African American Heritage Trail. You know, as you mentioned, Holly, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested in St. Augustine at a lunch counter. We had the Munson Lodge where the owner threw acid when they tried to integrate the pool, threw acid on Black people to get them out of the pool. That's not in Lincolnville. That's actually in the quarter. But
yeah,
all this stuff is all right there. So if you're listening, we'll put a link about Lincolnville in the show notes. But I just wanted to give that context before we go on.
Yeah,
as you said.
So people know, Kathy is doing she's not in her normal studio today. So she's trying to save bandwidth. That's why we keep talking over each other. But I was going to ask a similar question. What's kind of the rough boundaries of Lincolnville? Because I've been, what's the cultural center there in the old high school? Is that the Lincolnville, what's it called? I don't remember.
Was that Excelsior?
Yeah, the Excelsior High School. Is that kind of the center of Lincolnville? Like the area where the... where they make spirits. Is that part of Lincolnville? The distillery?
To be honest, I'm not sure of the
boundaries.
Lincolnville's borders.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's something maybe we can find something on a website and put in the show notes because I feel the same way, Kathy, that it seems like, you know, modern St. Augustine is encroaching in these historic neighborhoods every time I go and visit. And it saddens me, you know, because a lot of those places are modest, but you can see the character. And, you know, I've tried to follow, there are markers in some of those places. I think the guy who's a dentist, I think there's a marker in front of his home. Yep. And there was a tour, and that didn't exist when I first learned about, you know, all the civil rights stuff. So that's a real positive thing. And there's that one church too, that was very much at risk, that was just being held up by buttresses. You know, is that still there? The historic African-American church? It's south of, you know, the main part of town. Kind of southwest of the Alcazar or the Lightner. Actually, it's pretty much due west of that. It looked like if they had taken these buttresses off, the walls would have just fallen in.
Oh, I didn't see it when I was walking around.
Maybe it's gone.
Maybe it's gone already.
Oh, that would break my heart.
I think that's why St. Augustine has been doing these surveys. There's been, you know, several of them over the years, and the fact that they were focusing on the African American neighborhoods in the survey that I worked on and am working on, I appreciate that. You know, that's grant funded work that the city you know is doing, and just makes me appreciate the, you know, the laws and the Historic Preservation Act of 1966. I think about that and how it really provided a framework for preservation and allows surveys like the ones that I do. So for Historic Preservation Month, I just want to say thank you, Historic Preservation Act of 1966. You know, it's important, and I hope that nothing happens to it anytime soon.
Yeah, me too. Well, so there's also local designation at some places that might have more protection than national designation. Is that the case in St. Augustine? Do you know? Because I know, you know, my preservation work has mostly been in Winter Park, and, you know, they can still tear stuff down on the National Register. A great example is the Bellevue Biltmore, and that's, we've had Joey on our show, who was, you know, loves that place, but, you know, it was such a huge loss when they tore that thing down. And there's been, you know, what's the place the Beatles played in on Miami Beach?
I was just thinking about that, the Deauville. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's another big loss.
I can give you one closer to history in being torn down, and I don't think it's going to get torn down. In Gulfport, we have a historic casino that's on the National Register, and it was, the integrity was compromised during Helene, let's put it that way. And right now, you know, the big deal is those floors. It's been a casino. This is the third iteration of the casino, but this one was built by WPA workers, and the floors were soggy. And I mean, it's just a sodden mess, and the city wants to keep it, but they're having trouble getting it's the floors. They want, you know, to redo the floors. They're having some real trouble explaining to some people in the state that we need the money to redo the floors the right way, because this is what makes the building historic. So they're getting quotes of like $1 million to redo those floors. And that just feels like a lot for a very small city. Yes. So if you have any ideas here, Holly, we can talk after the show, and I'll be happy to pass those along. But this is a real life thing where people want to protect it, but the money to do it because of natural forces makes it.
Yeah. Let me know more about that. And maybe I can, you know, talk with some folks about what can be done.
I will definitely do that.
Yeah. It's hard. You know, the floors are wood there, right?
Yes.
Or where we're at wood, you know. So what the one project I was involved with was the facilities at Warm Mineral Springs in Northport. And, you know, it's right by the spring. So after the hurricanes, you know, water came in and went up 18 inches. And what they decided to do is to try and harden the facilities so that, you know, if water comes in again, it'll do less damage. So that there are parts of it that were interior spaces, they're going to, you know, kind of keep the shell of the building intact, but make them outdoor spaces so that the footprint is going to be there essentially maintained. You know, it was designed by Jack West, I think, at the Sarasota School. You know, I'd love to see the whole thing maintained as it was, but this is a great compromise because waters are going to come up, you know, in this day and age, that, and there's nothing you can do about that. And I think about that with the Gulfport Casino. it's likely you guys are going to get another hurricane and the waters are going to rise. Is there a way to harden the building so that, the damage is minimal? You know, maybe wood floors aren't the way to go.
Well, maybe enforce the sailboats that are in Boca Ciega Bay that smashed into the casino because they were improperly anchored.
Oh, is that part of what happened?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, if it was only flooding damage, I actually think with wood floors, that's pretty easy to mitigate. But not having a secure structure means you can't go in and start that mitigation because it's still open to the elements. It's a lot. I don't want to spend a lot of time. I emailed Holly. We'll talk about it later. She'll be a huge savior to the town if she can help. Holly, what's your favorite historic building? Before we go, because we are almost out of time.
What is your favorite
historic building? No pressure, by the way.
In the United States or
in Florida?
In Florida, okay. Oh my gosh.
I'm gonna go with the library downtown. Just to be that guy.
It's always got to be difficult, Rick.
It is quite a beautiful, beautiful building. It's one of my favorite buildings, other than Casa Feliz in Winter Park, is the Castillo de San Marcos in St. Augustine. And I almost forgot Marjorie Keenan Rawlings' house, obviously at Cross Creek. That house, when I go there, it's just something in my heart. It's just like I want to live here. I want to be the tour guide there. When I was there, there was a guy walking around with no shoes on and frying up bacon, and I was like, this guy's got the dream job. those buildings come to mind, but I'm sure I'm missing some cool ones.
That's such a good question, Kathy, for Preservation Month.
Well, I think it's always nice to have a little shout out to those great buildings that people can access and go see, because sometimes we talk about preservation and a lot of times they're private buildings. I mean, getting a designation doesn't make a building historic. It just makes it designated. I mean, doesn't make it public. I'm sorry. Having the designation doesn't make the building public. It just means that it's designated as historic. But yeah, I think that's a really good. But Thane, you gave up some good ones, some really good ones.
The Driftwood. I got to say the Driftwood.
In Vero Beach. Yeah.
Yeah, yes. The Driftwood.
Driftwood is also a building I love. So quirky, you know. So yeah, those are.
The Hall of Giants at McKee Botanical Garden. And I got to give a shout out to the Bagler College that when you go in through that courtyard, that first building, that's like a rotunda there. Like I go every time I'm in St. Augustine, I go there just to go into that space.
Like the
I love
City
it
Hall,
so much.
The Alcazar is so, you know, Florida's a beautiful building. It's like from big grand hotels to Mediterranean Revival to cute little you know, frame vernaculars like Marjorie Keenan Rawlings. Just beautiful.
It's a lot of state, a lot of different parts of the state that came about and came of age at their own different times. So the architecture style is going to be different. So anyway, thank you, Holly, for coming and sharing your architectural historical preservation. I don't know why I thought I had in the notes that you were an archaeological historian, and we're going to talk about that. But you did a great job. Thanks for being here. And Rick, you think we should thank all of our supporting members this week? Or
it's up to you. We can come back and do it. And I do want to give a special shout out to Ryan Worthington, because he was doing some great work on one of our state parks that was, again, under pressure from development. And he was on the ground taking video, and the person who was trying to do a land swap backed off. And I think Ryan was a big part of that. And
yeah, Ryan's become a very powerful voice. Yes. He definitely helped push that land swap off for now. So
yeah.
So okay, and, we'll thank everybody now then. Okay.
Okay.
Well, obviously we're gonna thank Ryan Worthington. If you don't follow Ryan Worthington, he's the Florida Excursionist on Instagram, and he has two podcasts, As Bad as It Gets with Ryan Smart of the Florida Springs Council, and his own Sunshine State Seekers, the Florida Madcaps. They hike across the state and have podcasts about it. Michael Gargolak is our longest supporting member. John Bowne, Angela Connolly, Natalie Zacharick, Davita Breyer, who, despite living in Maryland, has a wonderful book called Sinkhole about Lyrita, Florida. Leslie Hallweg, Carol Miller, Elise Smith, The Betts Boys Adventure. It's a dad and his two kids who go across the country and take videos of the kids doing stuff at museums and at baseball games so their family can see them, but anybody can watch. Their energy is really a lot of fun. Brian Woodall, who was our Florida bucket list winner, and he's on Instagram too. Brad Sager and Stephanie Hewley. And as always, we want to encourage everybody to support us by clicking on the support button. It's very inexpensive, a lot of fun. And for most levels, you get nifty postcards and some other cool stuff. So thank you.
You did it just in the nick of time.
And we're done. All right. Thanks, Holly. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you all so much. Thank you.
Bye.
We'll see everybody next week on the Florida Spectacular.
Bye. Thanks for joining us.